6 years in the 1990s, Gary Shandling's series The Larry Sanders Show was a hit on HBO. A knowing parody of talk shows, it was very funny and critically acclaimed. Now it's been collected on a 4-DVD box set with such wonderful extras as unedited, unscripted interviews with some of the show's guests. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Gary Shandling. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Patti Smith's new album of cover versions of other people's rock songs. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the first novel by Nathan Englander, best known for his short story collection, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest today, Gary Shandling, has a new DVD box set. It's called Not Just the Best of the Larry Sanders Show, and it's called that for a reason. While it includes about 24 episodes from Shandling's groundbreaking HBO comedy series, in which he played the fictional host of a late-night network talk show, it also includes what amounts to an entirely new series, a new type of talk show in which Gary just hangs out with people and talks, and talks. Gary Shandling has been approaching TV from his own unique viewpoint for a long time. His first TV series, It's Gary Shandling Show, prefigured the reality TV phenomenon by having Gary pretend to live his life while followed by a camera crew. Then he gave up a shot at being a real late-night TV talk show host, inheriting Johnny Carson's chair on The Tonight Show, to play one on TV on Larry Sanders. And with Rip Torn as his producer Artie, Shandling's Larry brilliantly deconstructed both the reality and history of TV talk shows.
Come on, it was great, Larry.
We killed $75,000 worth of spiders,
Artie. But we got $100,000 worth of laughs.
Oh, please.
Well, look at it this way. You finally got a chance to do a sketch with the great Carol Burnett.
It wasn't a sketch. It was a massive spastic up.
Well, tomato, tomato. It was broad physical comedy. It made the Ed Ames tomahawk throw look like a big piece of
Really?
I love that scene because it presumes the audience knows all about Ed Ames throwing that tomahawk and hitting the crotch of the drawn cowboy target on live TV on The Tonight Show. Shandling is fascinated with things that can happen in the moment, even when they go wrong. And that's the appeal of the extras on his new DVD box set. His idea is that when you let cameras run without edits, you eventually catch something real. And he's right. We interviewed him before the whole thing with Alec Baldwin's angry answering machine message to his daughter made headlines. But when Baldwin and Shandling are sparring at a boxing gym as cameras roll, their between-rounds discussion captures something quite revealing in retrospect.
Since my divorce, I'm not very secure about my message.
But
that's my DVD package on my best.
I'll come on your DVD and talk about your marriage.
There you go.
No,
I'll come on and talk about your ex.
But those relationships are most likely to cause some doubt as opposed to anything else, right?
Yeah.
Triggers all those buttons.
Let's talk about my divorce for like another 10 or 15 seconds, then let's box.
Yeah, that's good timing.
I'd rather, if we go in the area again, I'd rather talk
about
my
ex-wife. Let's put my ex-wife's divorce lawyer on speakerphone and let's rumble.
I spoke to Gary a few weeks ago and asked why he spent so much time and effort on the extras on his box set.
The fact is I couldn't do this DVD if there wasn't something new on it. It folds back into the idea that the show itself was new and sort of ahead of its time in a way. Would you agree with that? Or let's say not ahead of its time.
I have no problem saying ahead of its time.
Okay. And and I'm usually late, so it was quite an accomplishment.
Well, let's...
So, may I say, yes. Without forcing myself in, I could not believe, and I am proud, that people like Alec Baldwin, Sharon Stone, Jon Stewart... Seinfeld were willing to. Of course, they've worked with me. They'd all been on the show or something, and the trust that they had, and because I certainly went at them with nothing. I mean, I didn't have any intention. So by the time I was with Alec Baldwin in the boxing ring, which happened because I called him up and I said, I'm making this DVD, Alec, and I'm just shooting people with, nothing prepared. And he said, well, come on. We both know something's got to be prepared or it's going to be bad. He didn't use the word bad, but I don't know what the limitations are here.
We'll find out, probably.
Okay. So I said to him, something will be prepared, but it's just shooting us talking because I've... you know, the way we are, and it just runs, and I'm not going to interrupt it. And he just said, well, look, where do you want to do it? And I said, well, I happened to be standing right now in my boxing gym. And he said, oh, I used to box. I said, you want to do it here? And I had no intention of that. It's just that I let things happen. I let things happen creatively. I let the moment. And he met me at the boxing gym. And we ended up getting in the ring and moving around. And before I knew it, I said to him, because he's such a big, strong guy, I said, is there anything that threatens your masculinity? I was really interested because you're in boxing. It's a very tough game, and I can't, unless you've really been in the ring with somebody throwing punches at you, it's hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when my wife and I got divorced, my masculinity was threatened. And I said, ah, so. Like, he said, well, and then he interrupted me. He said, well, let's talk about my wife on my DVD.
Yeah.
and then he came at me with the gloves. And there's several moments like that that make you realize that everyone is just a person.
Well, you also got him to say right there, you asked if he had some sort of a fear of losing because you sensed that that was what motivated him to be so aggressive. So people get an idea of what we're talking about. I want to play that clip. Where you get to that moment where you ask him.
I think what it was, he was getting ready. He was throwing one big punch all the time, and he said, I'm a one-punch guy.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can go from there. So do you think that fear is what drives you sometimes, and I'm not kidding, in a scene, because you bring a lot of power to a scene? Do you also go into a scene and go, I'm going to win this? And
Yes.
I'll be damned.
I go into the scene and I say, I'm gonna kick your ass.
See, so that's what
that's what the scene requires.
That's what your essence is.
And I'm
mine is
win.
More. Mine is more dancing.
I'm
around.
Gonna win. We're gonna get down to it now, or right. We're gonna get down to it later. We're gonna get down to it on page one. We're gonna get down to it on page five. But I am gonna win. I just go in there.
There's vulnerability in that, though, isn't there?
Well, it all sounds.
So what I found fascinating about seeing this as part of the extra material is, by watching Alec Baldwin all season on 30 Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that from the very beginning, he came into that show with that very approach, that big, hard punch, I'm going to win the scene. And he's been celebrated by everybody for doing just that.
You're really a perceptive fellow. The fact is Alec Baldwin, right before that, he was throwing some big left hooks, and he said he does it because, and I realized, I said, why? He said, I gotta throw that big left hook because I'm afraid for the fight to go on, then I could get hurt, so I want to get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I said, well, that's what your acting is about, because you see, in Larry Sanders and how these all tie together, what I'm about is getting somebody's essence, their core self, and seeing what that struggle and those conflicts are in a very real way. So I've got to get to the bottom of the person. But his acting is, boxing is a metaphor for how you are in life. I find myself in my boxing style is kind of, I keep moving, I stick and jab, I jab and move, and I have fast hands, I have no good rhythm, so I use that to my advantage because the other guy can't find the rhythm. And then you realize, oh, my God, it's just like my comedy, which is you can't quite tell what the next thing's going to be
mm-hmm.
in that next moment. You don't see what's coming. This guy brings his core issue to his work, which is what makes him brilliant, which is I am coming in to win fast. So that drives him in a scene, and no matter what crosses him in that scene, he is trying to get it over with fast, and that gives him that power. And what he admits in that boxing ring is it's because he's scared.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't because he's confident that he can win. That wouldn't be interesting to watch. What's interesting to watch is a guy who is going to do anything to win.
So explain the irony to me about getting up to the point where you are guest hosting The Tonight Show and then leaving that rather than inheriting that in order to play a talk show host on your own show And then when it comes out with these new DVDs, going back and interviewing people and reinventing the talk show host interviewing form.
Here's what's different about these. I call them visits, you see, because if you try to describe them as interviews, any way you cut it, it doesn't describe it. Why they're different is because they're actually scenes out of life where people are behaving. And what you get on a talk show, or what we're doing to a large degree, is we're talking. First of all, we can't see each other, mm-hmm. which is too bad because that changes the energy. So we're talking, but we're not creating a scene. And what happened is, in these things, is a scene is allowed to be created. That's what fascinates me. So it's kind of a cross between talk show and rodeo. rodeo.
Now, was there any point when you were still guest hosting The Tonight Show when you had made the decision that you weren't going to take it and you started using it as research for the show you did want to do?
I remember us looking at the footage of Larry walking through the curtain the first time down the hallway, which was modeled after The Tonight Show. That design of the backstage is modeled basically after The Tonight Show. I did no research from being on the show because I'd done it enough. Mm-hmm. So I didn't stay on and do any more for research, but I did do the following research because I'm thorough, and I started as a writer. And
on
I've written
Sanford
a lot.
And Son, which I do want to ask you about.
You may. Okay. And so as a writer, I did my work very thoroughly in that I went and spoke to Peter LaSalle, who was the producer of The Tonight Show.
One of the nicest men I've ever met in Hollywood.
We had our we had our launch party for the DVD just the other night. Peter came to that, and he's now on the Craig Ferguson. I can't keep the titles straight of the actual shows anymore. It's the late show later than it used to be.
Yes, the late late show with Craig Ferguson.
Yeah, someone's got to do a show that's called I Can't Believe the TV Is Still On. I just made that up. Let's pitch that.
It's actually very good. Gary Shandling in an interview recorded late last month. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Gary Shandling, whose new box set, Not Just the Best of the Larry Sanders Show, has been released on DVD. One of the extras on that set is a portion of Shandling's very first stand-up appearance on The Tonight Show, back when Johnny Carson was host.
This is at the Comedy Store in Hollywood and at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, California. As I said, this is his first time, so make him feel welcome. Would you welcome Gary Shandling?
Wow, that's very nice. I'm so excited to be here. I had a great day. I went to the bank earlier today. And have you gotten your free pen yet? These are free. You just yank these things and they pop right out. And
There's never going to be anybody as important to comics as Carson was. That platform just is never going to exist ever again. And I'm wondering what your own favorite personal moment was as a performer on The Tonight Show, as a guest, and then as a host, what you treasure the most?
Well, my first Tonight Show was just one of those things. some combination of and I mean this seriously, a cosmic meant-to-be coming-together circumstance, because I actually tell people who say I'm thinking of doing stand-up comedy, I go, you don't do stand-up comedy unless it's your calling, because it's not worth it. It is so difficult. You work I did my work, mm-hmm. but it's in the hands of the gods. You walk out there to do your first Tonight Show. Is the audience going to be hot? Are you going to be on fire? It's like an athlete. Are you going to have your moves at a peak? And you know, I work in the moment. So if it starts to ignite, then I start to ignite, and it just took off. It was just a set that took off, and when I was done, I remember hearing Johnny say, well, first of all, he thanked the talent booker on the air, which is just
wow,
shocking. He actually turns and he says, "Thank you, Jim," which was to Jim McCauley, who saw me at the Comedy Store. And then he just said into the camera, "You're going to hear a lot about that guy." And I don't know that anything has topped that in terms of being a comedian. And while that's about ego, there's something much more about it. There's something about the fact that it was just meant to be, and you could feel it in the room. There was a place where the audience broke into applause, and Johnny fell off his chair, and you know, I'm not that funny. So it was a special night. I mean, I have my moments,
mm-hmm.
but boy, it was packed with emotion, and I think that's what I'm about. I felt emotional about it. I was backstage, and I it was just a goal of mine, and I was really sort of lost after that, because I really was just aiming to do the Tonight Show, and I always wanted to guest host the Tonight Show, and this is really important.
Why?
What I'm going to tell you. I don't know, and I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. I don't come from any show business background. I didn't study theater. I wasn't a performer. I'm a shy guy, writer. That's how I came to L.A. and wrote Sanford and Son, which we'll talk about in a second. And then what happened is I started to do stand-up, and I guess I watched The Tonight Show. And what's weird is I said to my agent at the time, I'd done my first Tonight Show that went well.
As a guest.
As I said, as a guest.
Okay.
So I say to my agent, is there any, you know, a shot that I could guest host? She said, get that out of your mind. Just get it out of your mind. That's never going to happen. Because Letterman was the last person, which was probably two or three years prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to have any new guest hosts. So just don't think about it. It's not in the cards. It just isn't going to, it's not possible. I do not like anybody putting limits on what anybody wants to do in their life. I would never say never to anyone. These are really important issues to me as a human being and creatively. If someone said, you know, is there, I'm thinking of doing this or that, I'd say, man, you got to go for that. It sounds like that's what you want to do. But she said, just get it out of your head. And about 2 months later, the phone rang. And they said Albert Brooks just canceled. He was supposed to guest host the Tonight Show tomorrow night. And I'm getting chills as I tell you this, because it was just the weirdest moment. And they said, but Albert Brooks is canceled, and they want you to do it. I can't remember the last time I had a reaction where I froze. I was panicked.
Mm-hmm.
I was not believing the words I heard, because I had gotten it out of... I don't know if I'd gotten it out of my mind, because I think those things are just meant to be in a way. And I thought, I've got... Okay, I mean, my hands were shaking, because I said yes. and I'd probably guessed it five times at that point. I'd guessed it five times, and I went to the one appearance, I went to the couch and made Johnny really laugh, because Carrie Fisher was on before me, and she was talking about her parents, Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher. Mm-hmm. And then when I came on, I sat down and I said, maybe you know my parents, Irv and Muriel Shandling. and Johnny knew that was funny on two levels, you know. And I get this call, and I'm thinking to myself, and I notice that my hands are shaking and my palms are sweaty, but I say to myself, okay, be nervous now, and then get to the work. And so the first time I guest hosted, it just went fantastically, and I had to go back and look at the tapes. I don't look at my old stuff. I could do 100 jokes now, but the fact is I don't look at my old stuff. And there, I did for this DVD. I had to look at me hosting The Tonight Show, and it spooked me when I saw how comfortable I was for the first time, because I'd never hosted anything. I wasn't a TV performer. It's just natural for me, I guess.
Gary Shandling, recorded late last month. We'll hear more from Gary in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, in select theaters May 11th. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, 12. Ken Tucker reviews Patti Smith's new album of covers. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Ministry of Special Cases, the first novel by Nathan Englander, whose short story collection For the Relief of Unbearable Urges got rave reviews. And we continue our interview with Gary Shandling.
We were talking about the space between us all and the people who hide themselves behind us.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Let's get back to my interview with Gary Shandling, who has spent the last few years revisiting old friends as part of the extras on his new Larry Sanders Show box set. Let me ask you just a couple of early career questions. I have to know what it was like as a white guy writing on Sanford and Son.
That show was written by Sol Turtletaub and Bernie Orenstein. And how I got a spec script to them through a very nice writer named Ted Bergman, who said, I think you're talented, write a spec Sanford and I'll get it to them. And I wrote a script, and you know, it's a miracle to get anything through, and they liked it and they called me in. and said, pitch some ideas. I said, well, Fred and Achu open up a Chinese restaurant. And it really works out until the health department closes it down. And they said, you're on. And that was my first one. And they said something to me that I've
used. See, I was going to say that's ridiculous because it takes them out of the junkyard, so they can't do that. But there you go.
Yeah, they opened it. They opened it in Fred's house. They put 12 tables or something like that.
Oh my! You wrote that? You wrote that?
Yeah, because Achu was a good cook, and so Fred said, you know, I know what we should do. We should open a Chinese restaurant. It was going real good. I don't remember how it ended. I remember the health department coming in and saying, "You're not zoned for this," but I don't remember the beats of the story. And then they said, pitch another one, and I ended up writing three that they shot in one season. And I didn't have an agent at the time. I had just moved from Tucson. I didn't know anybody when I moved to L.A. So someone said, you should call this agent. Here's the name of a good agent. I called this agent up, and he goes, so what have you written? Like, he couldn't be less interested. And I said, well, I've written three Sanford and Sons, and... David, I had also, while I was doing that, walked across the hallway to welcome back Cotter. And I walked in. I did. I walked in. I had no agent. And I said, I'm writing on Sanford and Son. Here's a spec welcome back Cotter script. And I had written a half a script that was really funny. And they called me, said, we love this. We want you to write a welcome back Cotter. So now I called this agent. And I said, he says, what have you written? With complete disinterest, and I said, three Sanford and Sons and a welcome back Cotter. He said, did you get them submitted?
Oh.
I said, no, they shot them. Now there's five beats of dead silence. And he says, are you telling me that you've written three Sanford and Sons and a welcome back Cotter that were bought and shot? I said, yeah. He said, can you be here at noon?
Should have been a tip-off.
And it turned out he was Norman Curlin was a great agent. And I got there at noon, and he had appointments already set up for me to meet other television people. And, you know, I had a budding career as a television writer. But in the middle of some pitch session for Three's Company, a voice in my head said, you just don't want to be doing this the rest of your life. And I started to do stand-up because I stunk. I didn't know anything, and I was so self-conscious. I thought, this is a good way to find out who I am, because I'd been meditating back then and everything and had this other path going the whole time, which was about self-realization and awareness and Zen Buddhism. And I had a study going on, a spiritual study going on. I would go out, David, I would go out camping every week. And I guess I just don't appear to be this way. I would go out every week because L.A. is so weird and show business is so weird. And I would take my dog and go camping, and I would meditate. And people would make fun of it if I told them, because now, of course, you can see a Buddha in a store window in Beverly Hills, so it's at least not as weird. It's a little more accepted. This is 25 years ago, and I stopped telling people that I was going off camping to meditate, and I think my dog stopped telling other dogs because I think they stared at the dog and went, "You mean you just sit there? You don't chase anything? He doesn't throw you a ball? You just sit there?"
Gary Shandling speaking late last month. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
If I would write his theme song, I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme together?
Gary Show. This is the theme to Gary Show, the opening theme to Gary Show. This is the music that you hear as you watch the credits. We're almost to the part of where I start to whistle. Then we'll watch It's Gary Shandling Show. This was the theme to Gary Shandling Show.
That was just what it said it was, the theme to Gary Shandling's show. It's the sort of self-aware fourth-wall playfulness that made that Showtime sitcom so fresh and new, while at the same time harking all the way back to the beginnings of network TV, when George Burns broke that fourth wall and spoke directly to the audience on the George Burns and Gracie Allen show. On It's Gary Shandling's show, all the people in Gary's life were very aware of television and often aware that they were on it. Here's a clip, which begins with Gary getting a visit from a nosy neighbor, played by Paul Wilson, and ends with Gary looking straight into the camera and talking to viewers at home.
Hey, Leonard.
Hi,
how's
Gary.
It going?
Fine.
Great.
Hey, listen. Word on the street is that the head of the network's coming over for dinner.
That's correct.
Good episode. What goes wrong?
What do you mean, what goes wrong? Nothing's going to go wrong.
Come on, Gary. It's a classic setup, Gary. Remember when Alan Brady came over to the Petries and Laura overcooked the turkey and all hell broke loose?
Leonard.
And Gary, you know, that wasn't even his first visit.
Leonard, this is the real world.
Yeah.
We'll be fine, all right?
Mind you, Gary, Mrs. Rayburn wasn't exactly Beaver's boss. She was only his principal, but I think the metaphor still applies. When she came over to the Cleavers and Wally embarrassed him by staying in his pajamas all during dinner.
Well, this is going to come as a big shock to you, but Wally's not going to be here tomorrow night. I don't think any of the Cleavers are, so thanks, really. And I gotta go. I gotta keep cleaning and get
okay.
ready, okay?
Have it your way, Gare, but that's the word on the street.
Okay, see ya.
And I can't wait.
Okay. Oh, brother. Look, I know that Phoebe and I haven't gone through this before, but we'll be fine. Sure, I'm a little nervous.
I'm wondering if there's any special insight into how you got so interested with It's Gary Shandling's show, the Showtime series that predated HBO's Larry Sanders, about a sitcom that would break the fourth wall. Was it going all the way back to George Burns? Was it Woody Allen? Who was it that intrigued you to try that?
The story is this. Michael Nesmith, who was one of the
Monkeys and one of the monkeys. You're talking television parts.
He did this series that was on I don't remember what network that he took.
NBC.
He was ahead of his time. He took music videos were just starting, and he said, "Why not do comic videos where you take a comedian and let him start talking, and then show the story like a video does?"
Mm-hmm.
And I did two of those. Kind of videos that I wrote for him because I got the concept, and that involved me talking directly to the camera, which I was mostly influenced through Woody Allen in Annie Hall, the way he stopped and turned and talked to the camera when he was in line at the movie theater. So I wasn't so up on George Burns and Jack Benny. It is before my I think that's even before my youth. I didn't watch those, so I didn't see those. But here's the important part of that connection. So these videos worked out so well that I thought, this gives me an idea of a way to do a series that is completely different, that where you talk to the camera and even include the audience in the story and get advice. And I saw the whole thing. And NBC was interested in me doing a series, and I went in and I talked to them about this idea where I talked to the camera, David.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and I talked to the camera, just as like they're my friend, and I go, can you believe this, or whatever I say. They said, well, we like the whole story. It was a simple thing of me being a comedian and having a platonic girlfriend and just matters that go on in regular life, but talking to the camera as well. We're just uncomfortable with you talking to the camera, they said at NBC, because people watch sitcoms because they want to feel like they're looking in. And that, so we don't. I said, well, using that theory your newscasters should be talking to each other, and we should just feel like we're looking in. And they froze on the idea that it's different. Then they said, here's the thing you brought up. Then they said, now, would you have to be a comedian because no one, you know, understands show business and what does a comedian go through? And I said, wow. I said, George Burns, in the history of TV, George Burns, Jack Benny played themselves. They were comedians. They were in show business. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't mean to counter your argument.
But I'm countering your argument, yeah.
And I did actually write some script where they said, could you do it by talking to your dog instead of the camera? And I guess I wasn't strident enough to say no. So I wrote a script where I actually did talk to a dog, and then I Showtime said, we want you to do anything you want. And that's the key to getting to me. And I went and did it at Showtime where they were hands-off, as was HBO. I mean, I don't mind. I like input. I like help and input and all that. But if you got a core idea, go.
Well, Gary Shandling, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on Fresh Air. It was fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Gary Shandling, interviewed a few weeks ago. Not just The Best of the Larry Sanders Show, featuring dozens of episodes and all those extras, is now out on DVD. Since she began her recording career in the 1970s, Patti Smith has proven to be a fan of cover versions of some of her favorite songs, such as Van Morrison's Gloria. She's just released an album consisting entirely of other people's songs, a dozen covers called 12. Rock critic Ken Tucker speculates on what has drawn Smith to record versions of songs by acts ranging from The Doors to Nirvana to the Rolling Stones.
That's Patti Smith covering the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter, which certainly takes some nerve. And her band, assisted by Tom Verlaine on slide guitar, really does justice and then some to the song's primal power. What makes this album 12 such an artistic success is that Smith approaches every song, no matter how familiar, with a blissful or willful disregard for the ways pop culture may have turned any of her chosen songs into a classic or a cliché. She's unfettered by notions of kitsch or irony, which makes one of the more surprising choices here, the 1985 Tears for Fears song Everybody Wants to Rule the World, surprisingly listenable.
Welcome to your life.
On that song, Patti Smith hones in on the lyric, teasing out the purity of its sentiment. She brings the prettiest version of her singing to a pop song that I never thought I wanted to hear again. Smith breaks down your defenses with sheer earnestness. The album's most triumphant example of this is her interpretation of Jimi Hendrix's Are You Experienced, a song so intricate and unique that it would seem to defy a fresh restatement. Yet Patti Smith pulls it off.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. Are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have.
Most of the time on this album, Patti Smith is working out songs with her longtime band, especially guitarist Lenny Kaye. They leap around decades, from the Beatles' Within You, Without You, to a 1970s Bob Dylan song, Changing of the Guards, to Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. On that last one, she also pulls in a bunch of friends, including the playwright Sam Shepard, who plays banjo. Together, they turn Kurt Cobain's early 90s anthem into a piece of folk blues. The result is another unlikely triumph of sharp-eared sincerity over mere familiarity.
Fun to lose and to pretend she's overboard, myself assured. I know, a dirty word. Hello, 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 hello. With the lights out, it's less dangerous.
I think it's great that Patti Smith, who over the years has been accused of not singing well, and who also was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just this past year, shrugs off every criticism and accolade. She just pursues a life in art, whether it's writing songs, writing poetry, or in the case of this album, demonstrating how an artist can combine a fan's sensibility. She gives vocalists younger or more technically accomplished than her a lesson in how to interpret popular music in unexpected, visceral ways.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed a new album of covers by Patti Smith called 12. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on author Nathan Englander. This is Fresh Air. It's been 8 years since Nathan Englander's award-winning short story collection For the Relief of Unbearable Urges was published. Since then, he's been working on a novel. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
When Nathan Englander's short story collection For the Relief of Unbearable Urges was published to near universal critical acclaim, he was compared to Isaac Bashevis Singer, Kafka, Gogol, the usual fabulist lineup. Now Englander's first novel has just come out. It's called The Ministry of Special Cases. And in praise of it, I want to throw a lowbrow comparison into the mix. Jack Finney's classic tale of terror, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Most people know it from the 1956 movie of the same name or the Donald Sutherland 1970s remake. As cheesy as Finney's writing style could be, he also wrote the New York City time travel novel Time and Again. He had a knack for writing fantasy fiction that also engaged politics, as well as enduring human anxieties and yearnings. At the time the first movie version came out, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was read as an expression of Red Scare paranoia. But it keeps being remade. A fourth movie version is due out this year, because through the sci-fi form, Finney captured the horror of watching a person you love change, become alien. Englander might or might not appreciate the comparison to Finney, but he's working the same crazy quilt turf. The Ministry of Special Cases is fantasy fiction whose all-too-real political subject is Argentina's dirty war of the 1970s, as well as the timeless horror of standing by helpless as a loved one is taken, whether by disease, accident, or in this case, the sadistic machinations of a military junta. We readers know we're not on the firm ground of literary realism from the first page of this novel when we meet our hero, the portentously named Kaddish, hard at work at his clandestine job, that is, chiseling away the names of the dead on tombstones in a Jewish cemetery in Buenos Aires. The year is 1976, and Kaddish has been hired by respectable members of that city's Jewish community to obliterate criminal family history, specifically the names of parents and grandparents on tombstones planted in the part of the cemetery reserved for gangsters, pimps, whores. No one in these nervous political times wants to get in trouble for being related to the wrong person. Or as Kaddish cheerfully explains to his wife, with the new regime, the shame industry is about to bloom. Kaddish may be happy to make a buck off political turmoil, but his wife Lillian is jumpy. To protect her family, she spends much of her secret savings installing a steel front door to their apartment. Wouldn't you know it, all Lillian's fortifications against approaching disaster come to naught. When Kaddish hears someone knocking at the door one night, he distractedly opens it. The secret police step right in and take away the couple's 19-year-old son, a surly college student nicknamed Pato. The rest of the Ministry of Special Cases reads like a series of ingenious riffs on the same situation. Two people, Kaddish and Lillian, banging their heads against a wall, desperately trying to navigate the bureaucracy to find their disappeared son. Englander's brilliance rests not so much in plotting, but in images, phrases, scenes, moods that acrobatically somersault into their opposite. Think of that vault-like apartment door undone from the inside. In an absurdist set piece, Kaddish barters with a plastic surgeon. He agrees to obliterate the surgeon's shady father's name from his tombstone if the surgeon will give him and Lillian nose jobs. They both boast massive honkers. Englander plays the recurring nose job subplot for all its zaniness. Lillian's nose keeps getting botched. When she wants it to be smooth, it comes out corrugated. When she wants it restored to its original massive proportions, it comes out pert. Except that, in a swift darkening of the tone, Englander makes us realize that Lillian wants her original big nose back because it's the same nose that her missing son sports. Like those tombstone names Kaddish erases, Lillian's familial connection to Pato has been ground down. A haunting parable about political and metaphysical instability, The Ministry of Special Cases is the kind of unruly book that can give you the giggles and the chills simultaneously. Similar to the hero's waking nightmare in Finney's thriller, Englanders Argentinian Jews wake up one day to find that their whole country has turned into a pod.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Nathan Englander's first novel, The Ministry of Special Cases. Alvin Batiste, the New Orleans clarinetist and music teacher, who played with Ray Charles and whose students included Branford Marsalis, died yesterday of a heart attack in his hometown. He was 74. Batiste died hours before he was to appear on stage at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival with Marsalis and Harry Connick Jr. in a concert program titled Marsalis Music Honors Alvin Batiste and Bob French. The record label Marsalis Music released a CD saluting Batiste last month. We'll close with a song from that recording. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. During National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong family connections for all kids in foster care at aecf.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, crucial moments and courageous decisions in presidential history. We talk with historian Michael Beschloss, author of Presidential Courage, and hear some audio tape of those moments featuring FDR, Harry Truman, and JFK. Join us for the next Fresh Air.